generally speaking, you do lose your recovery. You tend to need more recovery. There are joint issues, which training more frequently can sometimes have negative effects on that. So, yeah, usually you're going to have to manage your volume and frequency to a greater extent with people as they get older.
Welcome to Peak 40, the podcast that brings you the tips, tactics, and stories for living your best life in midlife. If you're in your mid-30s to 50s, Peak 40 is the place to get actionable advice on the nuances of nutrition, training, recovery, and mindset in midlife. For the full experience and other valuable resources, register for the Peak 40 weekly newsletter at drbubs.com/peak40 to enhance your lifestyle and start making midlife your best life. Welcome back, or welcome to the Peak 40 podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Bubbs. This is season 3, episode number 4. And in this episode, I'll be sharing an interview I did a few years back with muscle scientist, Dr. Brad Schoenfeld. Brad is a professor of exercise science at Lehman College in the Bronx, New York, widely regarded as one of America's leading strength and fitness researchers, where he serves as the graduate director of the Human Performance and Fitness Program. Dr. Schoenfeld has published more than 250 peer-reviewed scientific papers on various exercise and sports nutrition-related topics. In this episode, you'll learn about the incredible benefits of exercise for longevity and fighting off chronic diseases, the minimum effective dose for sets and reps to build and maintain muscle mass as you age, how to adjust your training volume when life gets busy, when to use NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and when not to. And of course, Brad will give us some tips on his strategies for time-efficient exercise. And this is important because in midlife, there are lots of demands to your day and you are time poor. And so this is a great conversation with Brad to really highlight how you can become more efficient with what you're doing in regards to exercise or in the gym. Find that minimum effective dose where you can get results, where you can achieve your goals, improve how you look and feel, but not have it take up your entire schedule. Tremendous. Before we get started, a quick announcement. Our Peak 40 coaching program prices will be increasing in 2024 due to high demand. So I appreciate all the feedback and all the interest, but we will be increasing those prices in 2024. And we're excited to be offering more features and more benefits in the program for folks as well. But if you'd like to take advantage of the 2023 pricing before the price increases, or perhaps gift someone in your family or a friend Peak 40 coaching for the new year, you can take advantage of that 2023 pricing until Friday, December 8th. All right, let's get started my conversation with Dr. Brad Schoenfeld. Brad, really appreciate you taking the time out today.
My pleasure, Mark.
Listen, before we jump into all things building lean muscle and fat loss, can you tell the listeners a little bit about how you got into exercise and then, you know, the research side of things?
Yeah, I'm not sure we have time for the whole story. But
the abbreviated version?
To kind of give you the truncated version, I was a really skinny kid coming out of college, was really unhappy with my physique, and found resistance training. It changed my life, and long story short, it led me on the path of wanting to pursue this as a career.
Phenomenal. It's amazing how some of those roadblocks in life steer us in a direction that that really shape us, right?
Yeah.
Now, if we jump right in by talking strength and size, you know, is there a real ideal, you know, repetition range or loading zone to promote the greatest gains in terms of hypertrophy?
No, not really. It's interesting. Certainly when I was coming through school, graduate school, that's the way it was always taught, that your hypertrophy range was 6 to 12 reps, 6 to 12 RM, and you had your strength range, which is for maximizing muscle strength, 1 to 5 reps, and your high reps are for muscle endurance. And I've carried out now a number of studies along with some of my colleagues, and really what we found is that hypertrophy can be obtained over a very wide spectrum of loading zones, and that really there's not substantial differences in the hypertrophy that is obtained. So you can get big with lower reps, moderate reps, higher reps. There is some emerging evidence that you can that different repetition ranges will target different muscle fiber types, specifically that your higher reps will tend to target the type 1 fibers, the endurance-oriented fibers, and type 2 will tend to target the type 2X fibers, which are the more strength-related fibers. But that's a more those are really subtleties. It's not a either-or that one only gets, let's say lightweights only get the type 1s and heavy loads only get the type 2s. That's certainly not the case. They both will produce substantial increases in hypertrophy across the spectrum of loading ranges. But for those who are looking to maximize muscle growth, it does lend credence to training across the spectrum of loading zones.
Phenomenal. Now, if we talk, you know, in terms of sets, the amount of sets that someone needs to maximize some of these gains, if we think about first just a young athlete trying to increase strength and size, is there an ideal number of sets per week?
Well, it's not an ideal number of sets, but there certainly is a good amount of evidence that higher volumes will equate to greater muscular adaptations, particularly hypertrophy. Strength is somewhat equivocal. There is, I think that it's more related to hypertrophy than strength, but certainly strength, the more you can practice a movement, especially if the goal is to get stronger in that particular movement, the greater the transfer. So when you say, is there an optimal number, that really is specific to the individual because, first of all, there's an inverted U curve, meaning that you will continue to get benefits up to a certain point, and then not only will those benefits trail off, but after a certain point, you can become overtrained from it, so they'll have negative consequences with too much volume. And the other important factor is that there's a huge inter-individual variability in terms of the recovery response, and thus what might be a good amount of volume for one person might be inadequate or too much for another.
And if someone's working, you know, if we shift gears here a little bit and just talk about the average client who's working a desk job 9 to 5 and they're trying to figure out, you know, how little do they have to do in a week in order to still make some gains? Is there sort of a minimum effective dose that people can shoot for per week?
So we carried out a meta-analysis, and our results showed that a minimum of 10 sets per week was better than lower 10 sets per muscle group per week. So biceps, triceps, chest, whatever. Was better than lower volumes. With that said, that's where when it comes to practical application, it really comes down to what someone's preferences are and their goals and abilities. There is a compelling evidence that a HIIT routine, high intensity training, which is one set to failure, can promote substantial increases in muscle growth. So it really then depends upon if someone wants to maximize their gains, yeah, then I'd say probably a minimum of around 10 sets per muscle per week is in that realm is what they should do. But if someone is limited on time, if they're saying, you know what, I'm good with getting 75% of my gains, and which a lot of people probably are and should be, then substantially less volume is viable.
That's a great take-home point, because I know obviously for a lot of people, even just you know, complaining about lack of time, even for young athletes, is a big concern. Yep. Now, as we talk about even older athletes or just, again, 50, 60 plus in terms of longevity, I know protein requirements increase as we get older. How about in terms of exercise? Is it, you know, decreasing training volume? Is that a wise approach? Do people need you know, more sessions but less volume? What's the ideal approach as people get into their 50s, 60s, 70s?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I can give a general answer, but of course the specifics, I have worked with individuals that were in their 60s and even 70s who can really run circles around people in their 20s.
Wow.
But generally speaking, you do lose your recovery. You tend to need more recovery. There are joint issues, which training more frequently can sometimes have negative effects on that. So yeah, usually you're going to have to manage your volume and frequency to a greater extent with people as they get older.
And you recently contributed to a piece there in Time Magazine. Now, you know, for myself in general practice, exercise is such a huge component in terms of helping people with blood sugar management, overall health, cognitive function. Can you share a few of the highlights there of the piece that you contributed to for Time Magazine, how exercise is so key for overall health?
Yeah, really the essence of that article was that resistance training is going to affect almost every bodily system you have in a positive manner. And we often think of resistance training as for jack bodybuilding or for maximal powerlifting to maximize strength. But there are so many, and certainly resistance training is extremely good at doing that, but it has so many other positive effects on your health, well-being, mental state, including improvements in bone density, enhancements in cognitive function, reducing depression, enhancing cellular health, reducing chronic inflammation in the body, reducing the amount of enhancing insulin sensitivity, so thus reducing the risk of diabetes and insulin insensitivity. And I can go on and on. Better posture, your skin looks better. Yeah. it's such a terrific modality, such a terrific strategy to incorporate into your life, and ultimately it really is the closest thing we have to the fountain of youth.
Phenomenal. I'm glad to have experts like yourself saying that, so I can just play that back for all my patients, so much appreciated there. If we shift gears on the weight loss side of things, I know one of the most common refrains I hear from clients is that they're, especially clients who are, let's say, 20, 30, 40 pounds overweight, significant abdominal fat, and of course typical notion of increasing the amount of meals they consume in a day to boost metabolism and help them to lose weight, oftentimes to limited effects. Can you share some of the recent findings on that topic?
As far as meal frequency?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's very little to no evidence that a high frequency of eating is beneficial. So more than, let's say, 3 meals, certainly more than 4 meals. From an anabolic perspective, I would say there is some evidence suggesting that three to four meals a day maximizes muscle protein accretion, so muscle protein synthesis, which is the precursor. It's how you gain muscle. So for those looking to maximize muscle mass, I would say at least 3 square meals would be beneficial. Certainly, it's not like you don't gain if you're eating less, but you certainly will. But I think from a optimization standpoint, that's the case. As far as fat loss, really no good evidence that there's any specific number of meals that is better than another. A intermittent fasting protocol, which is really taking the total number of meals and cramming them into a very short window, usually 6 to 8 hours or so. So that's usually 2 meals, depending upon how it's structured, has been shown to be a very fine way to lose weight. Not that it's better than eating more frequently, but certainly it's viable, meaning that really the frequency should come down to personal preference.
And do you see, I mean, I often see people when they start out on various programs, if there is increased meal frequency, the snacks might be, eggs or protein shake or something like that. And then as the weeks roll by, the months roll by, all of a sudden it might be a granola bar or a muffin, or, the quality of the snack tends to shift over. Can you speak to how that would impact, total caloric intake and their capacity to lose weight?
Yeah. So of course, the one thing that you have to appreciate with nutrition is that, food is just abundant around us. So people respond differently. Some people can have greater willpower, for lack of a better term, and just stick with a diet and be very regimented. You say, all right, I'm going to have 5 meals a day, and it's going to be every 3 hours, and they're setting their watch, and they get a little alarm that goes off, and boom, they'll bring Tupperware. I mean, certainly bodybuilders are the prime example of this, and you could tell them to eat wheatgrass and snow.
Phenomenal compliance, right?
That's their meals, and they'll pack that in Tupperware and they'll adhere to it. But most people don't have that type of ability, and that's why diets need to be specific to the individual. You have to look to promote adherence. Of course, adherence is you can give someone the perfect diet if they're not adherent to it. does no good. So yeah, if you're going to, it really comes down to calories in, calories out. Now there are certainly, I don't want to minimize macronutrients. Protein intake is extremely important there, and higher protein intakes have not only been shown to enhance retaining muscle mass, if not improving it, but also mitigating hunger, which is a huge issue, of course, and many other factors. And of course, there are micronutrient considerations that are garnered in the types of foods you eat. But from a pure weight loss standpoint, it does come down to calories and energy out. And that means what you're taking in versus what you're expending. And you have to manage that. If you don't, if you're going to be in a caloric surplus, you're going to gain weight. And if you're in a caloric deficit, you will lose weight.
Yeah, I recently had on Dr. Stefan Guillene, and he'd mentioned that low-carb diet's obviously a very popular way to lose weight and to get into a caloric deficit, and he strongly believed that the increase in protein intake was one of the real driving factors behind the benefits of a low-carb diet. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, in comparison to normal, the way people normally eat.
Yeah.
So ketogenic diets are going to tend to have higher protein, where they're, number one, there's a very high thermic effect of food with protein. And for those who don't know, a thermic effect of food is the calories that are expended in the digestive process. And protein, about 25% of the calories are ultimately burned off, whereas in carbs, they're 6% or 7%. In fats, they're less, they're 2% in some studies. So you're going to just in that respect lose a lot of calories. It's extremely difficult to gain weight eating protein. So what I would say with ketogenic diets that, yeah, that's part of it. And the fact that the higher protein tends to promote greater satiety makes them eat less food. So and there is some other research showing that ketosis in itself might enhance satiety as well. That's not been well established, but I would certainly say that the higher protein intake is a primary driver. And look, the vast body of literature shows that on a equated, when you control the calories and when you control the amount of protein in diets, there is no difference in weight loss between ketogenic diets versus low-fat diets. They're really the ratio of carbs to fats means little to nothing. Provided that your protein and your calories are equated.
Hey friends, if you want to keep up to date on all the science related to midlife nutrition, training, and lifestyle, sign up for our Peak 40 newsletter for monthly updates on tips, tactics, and strategies to implement and level up your routine. Also, a big thank you to all those leaving us reviews for the Peak 40 book. Really appreciate the time, effort, and feedback. If you'd like to pick up a personalized copy of Peak 40, to gift somebody over the holidays, just head over to drbubs.com/shop and order one for the holidays this year. And please do keep those reviews coming in. We really appreciate the feedback. All right, let's get back to the conversation. Now, if we circle back to nutrition for hypertrophy, for gaining size, I know that energy balance is so critical for a lot of the molecular pathways that support hypertrophy. Can you share some of the insights there?
Well, you need to be in the early stages of training, you can actually have what's called body recomposition, where you lose fat and gain muscle at the same time. You still will not maximize either one or the other. Or if you're going to try to lose more weight, it's going to really mitigate the amount of muscle that you can gain. So you might be able to eke out a little bit of muscle growth, which has been shown. It's been shown in my lab, but you won't maximize it. And really, for maximizing either one, if you want to maximize fat loss, really your goal should be to hold on to muscle as much as you can. And certainly for maximizing muscle growth, you need to be in a caloric surplus, meaning that you need to be taking in more calories than you expend. And the goal generally should be to do that while trying to minimize fat gain. The old bulking and cutting strategies tend to result just in a lot of muscle loss when you're cutting down. So the best way, some people call it a clean bulk, but to try to, you're going to gain some fat. That's really inevitable when you're looking to maximize muscle growth, but you can do it in a way that when you actually start to cut down again, you won't lose as much muscle, and that involves not gaining as much fat.
And is there a general range for people to shoot for if they're looking to get that energy balance above their day-to-day?
Yeah, somewhere between 200 to 400 calorie surplus. It can be, depends on the person. Hard gainers sometimes need even more, but usually in that 200 to 400 calorie surplus range is a good target to shoot for.
Absolutely. And one of the things that surprised me in your book, Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy, was this idea that we know that low-fat diets can often contribute to T levels reducing, but this idea of very high-fat diets as well being linked in some studies. Can you share some insights there?
Yeah, so testosterone, now I will say this with the caveat that the amount of disturbances, if you will, with T ratios are not all that great. So I'm not sure, when I say I'm not sure, really there's no good literature to guide us in this fashion as to really what effect that has. So the general consensus is that normal, quote unquote normal, testosterone levels are in the 300 to 800 nanogram per deciliter range. So 300 to 800 within that range. So if you go, let's say, from 500 to 400, which technically that's a large drop, that's a 20% reduction in testosterone, I have not seen any evidence that that would have a negative effect on anabolism. Now, doesn't I something I wouldn't want, and without knowing, I would say it's not a good thing. But how it affects you, I'm just not clear. But yeah, the consumption of dietary fat is related to your T levels and other hormonal levels as well. And low-fat diets certainly have negative effects on testosterone. When I say low-fat, usually we're talking less than 20, 15% or so. So very, really very low-fat diets. And when you're taking in a lot of saturated fat, it tends to decrease cellular signaling capabilities, whereas your unsaturated fats enhance cellular signaling. So if you're taking in a lot of saturated fat, at least there is some evidence that it can have a negative effect on testosterone as well as some other hormonal markers.
So some people should watch their the morning fat bombs there in the coffee with the butter and the MCTs and everything else might be perhaps a
Yeah,
little much
well,
for
I'll
some
go
people.
on record in saying there is really zero evidence to support that type of strategy, the buttered coffee strategy, and that's it's gotten a lot of hype, and I think it's unfortunate how gimmickry can sell.
Absolutely. Now, another common thing that we hear about, obviously, in terms of gaining size, is this idea of really promoting a big insulin release after training, and we're going to go looking for things that help to spike insulin levels in terms of our meal choices. What does a regular meal do to insulin? Is there a point or a plateau in which the benefits, for hypertrophy would plateau or even negate?
Yeah, so about 2 times resting levels seems to be the threshold physiologically, without taking, obviously, if you're going to take illegal insulin, which I never would recommend to anyone, it's extremely dangerous, but those are practices that some bodybuilders might use. But in a endogenous fashion, meaning within the body, from a normal physiological level, it's important to realize, first of all, that insulin really is not an anabolic hormone, at least at physiological levels, but rather an anti-catabolic hormone. So it actually, its benefit is to prevent protein breakdown, really not to increase muscle protein synthesis to much of an extent. And you're normal, as long as you're not starving yourself. If you're eating regular foods, you'll get insulin spikes that will be enough to promote any anti-catabolic effects that are necessary, providing you're eating enough meals throughout the day. Again, if you're having 3 regular meals throughout the day, there shouldn't be any issues as far as that goes.
Gotcha. Now, in training camps and even just athletes throughout the season or folks who are training a lot themselves, discomfort, pain, the use of, NSAIDs, ibuprofens to help take the edge off, and all of a sudden you might get some guys even taking them before they train. What's that doing to the adaptive response to exercise? Is there a time and place for it, and can we get too much of a good thing?
It's an interesting topic. The way the literature looks at this point is that it probably is specific to the age group that you're looking at. Age group a lot, and then the specifics, even with younger, it could be specific to what the person is going through, and I'll explain that in a minute. But I want to preface it by saying that the occasional use of NSAIDs, there's really no evidence that that will have a negative effect. So if there's you had a hard workout and you want to down some NSAIDs just to have less soreness or whatever, that's really not going to affect you negatively.
Gotcha.
But where I want to focus is on the chronic use, where people are taking these over the course of months. In elderly subjects, interestingly, there is evidence that it has positive effects on muscle group, positive effects.
Wow.
And that may be due, it's speculated, it may be due to the fact that elderly people tend to have high chronic levels of inflammatory bodies. So this chronic inflammatory environment is counteracted by NSAIDs. And thus that may be driving a greater hypertrophic response, because there is certainly a lot of evidence that high levels of chronic inflammation will be catabolic and thus impair muscle growth. Whereas younger people who generally do not have a inflammatory environment, usually they have low levels of chronic inflammation, there might be some negative effects due to a impairing of satellite cell activation. And satellite cells, just to give the short course on it, donate their nuclei to, they're basically quiescent, they're kind of stem cells, muscle stem cells, that donate their nuclei to muscles when needed to allow the muscle to synthesize more proteins. Nuclei are what synthesize more muscle proteins within the cell, muscle cells. And by impairing that, and there is some evidence that NSAIDs may impair the satellite cell response, this may ultimately have negative effects in younger people while having positive effects in older people. And that's a topic that really is still sorting itself out from a research standpoint.
Wow, that's really interesting in terms of the elderly population. Now, I know I want to respect your time here, Brad. I know you travel a lot with all the speaking engagements, UK, Europe, etc. Do you have any personal strategies that you use on the road to keep moving and get some time-efficient exercise in?
Well, I always just try to get at least one or two sessions. You can maintain muscle over somewhat short periods without really doing much once you've accumulated it. So I always try to find either a gym, and even if I don't, I can do just the cool thing we talked about with high rep training. I could do a lot of push-ups and chins, just finding some place in a park or something where you can at least get the major muscles trained using some lighter load strategies. But there's really almost anywhere I go, there'll be some type of gym that'll have at least some weights or machines that I can get a decent workout in, or even if it's less than decent, good enough where it doesn't impair me. And then when I come back, I hit it hard.
Awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about your morning routine when you are, in the day to day? Are you a coffee drinker? How does your morning look like when you're gearing up for a day's work?
Yeah, I always start my morning off with a major cup of coffee. But yeah, I get up early. I'm an early riser. I find that I get my work done better, the bulk of my work. So I try to really make sure I get anything important done so that it doesn't, things don't crop up where I'm not able to do it later. And I'll spend the first few hours, I get up usually around 5:30 in the morning, and spend the first few hours getting work done at my computer, a lot of writing done with a nice cup of coffee and a good breakfast. I walk my dog in the morning. I have a beautiful pet bulldog, Winston Churchill Schoenfeld.
Nice.
That's how I get my cardio. And then really it depends on the day. It's just so variable. I have so many things going on. So I'm at school, I'm doing research, teaching, have other engagements that I tend to. So just a lot going on, and really everything then diverges from there. But my morning is always pretty much the same, and it's several hours of paperwork, answering emails, and other such duties.
Nice. Well, coffee, exercise, and getting outside sounds like a pretty good way to start the day. Now, last question for you, kind of a 30,000-foot view. If you had to give yourself some advice, if you look at yourself 10 years ago and you had to give yourself some advice, what advice would that be?
That's a great question. I would probably tell myself to be more patient. I tend to want things to go at 100 miles an hour, and sometimes you can make mistakes along the way when you do that, and I think it doesn't really, it pays to have some perspective, you know, looking back. So I think having patience would probably be the most salient advice I could give myself now. And I do try to adhere to that, although it's very hard.
Sure. No, that's great. Great advice. Well, listen, Brad, I thank you so much for taking the time out today. I mean, your work's phenomenal. It's definitely a major part of our paradigm in terms of nutrition at Canada Basketball. Where can people stay connected with your work, and where can people pick up the phenomenal books?
Yeah, so I have a website called lookgreatnaked.com. That's Look Great Naked, not Look Good Naked, which is apparently some other type of site that I don't recommend people check out. And I have a blog that I do post on. I haven't, unfortunately, posted as much as I like recently. I'm all over social media, so they can search me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, the primary ones I use. And I have a couple books out, as you mentioned, or actually three of them, but I have a textbook called The Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy, which is really my pride and joy. It's something that really the culmination of my career as a educator. And it's a scientific read, so you need at least some background there. But if you really want to know the scientific basis of muscle growth and the practical implications, then that's a really good read. And I have two consumer books, a book called The Max Muscle Plan, another called Strong and Sculpted. Both of them just lay out different plans for optimizing body comp.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Well, listen, if you have any questions, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Dr. Bubs. Use the hashtag Peak40 so we can find those questions easily and use them on a future episode. And if you found this useful, please share with friends, colleagues, or anyone looking for Peak 40 health and performance.
The Dr. Bubs Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubs Performance Podcasts.